Welcome to the Real Sports Guys podcast. Jonah Carey, the author of The Extra 2%, which was a bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list, recently stopped by to talk to the guys from the Inside the Park crew. During his interview, Jonah talked about his book, The Extra 2%, Tim Lincecum's recent struggles, how he feels the Detroit Tigers will do this year, as well as his upcoming book on his beloved Montreal Expos. Hope you enjoy the podcast. Remember to check out the Inside the Park show on the Real Sports Guys Network, which comes on every Wednesday at 8:30 Central.
We got Jonah Carey coming on, acclaimed author. This guy is author of The Extra 2%, a book all about the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. I like to call it the new money ball. Jonah, are you there?
I am. You know that by calling them the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, you will be fined $1. My team president, Matt Silverman, that's going to happen. He's going to call you up and take $1 from you.
You know what? And I've read your book twice, and I know better. I'll be getting a letter in the mail and a fine. I would do that when you come on there. How you doing, brother?
I'm good. Everything is good. I'm over at Coors Field. Actually, I'm covering the Rockies and the Giants and watching Tim Lincecum get lit up a little bit, surprisingly.
You know what? We were just talking about that. Is there something going on with his velocity? What's going on with Tim Lincecum?
I wouldn't worry too much about it, and I know I heard you guys talking just before you brought me on about this whole idea of the first week and what he did with small sample size and so forth. His velocity is pretty okay. That is something that I would worry about, though, if a pitcher had problems like that. I mean, the guy that's bothering me a little is actually Josh Beckett, because his velocity was down from what it's been in the past, and his location was terrible, too. I mean, it just looked like he was supposed to have a thumb injury, and he sort of wondered, well, was he favoring his thumb? Is that what's causing him to throw straight and slow, which is a terrible combination, but you know, if you're talking about someone who would make you nervous, well, I don't think Lincecum is the guy that Beckett might be.
Interesting. I think I was rooting all over the place in the offseason to watch out for Lincecum, the perceived down year from his standards, and it's funny to see that come to fruition, but I was at that game, the Beckett game in Detroit, and you're like, the ball was flying out of the park that day.
Oh, yeah. And it's a good listen. The Tigers are a great team. I mean, you talked about your Tigers and how good they are. There's no question about it. They have power hitters up and down the lineup. And there's no shame in giving up home runs to Prince Fielder and Miguel Cabrera. But, you know, maybe you do it once. I don't know if you do it five times. He absolutely got shelled in that game. And, yeah, you saw it live. You can attest. He didn't look like vintage Beckett, that's for sure.
Indeed. And I want to say I'm happy to have you on. I'm a big fan of your book. And
thank you.
Because we're going to talk to you about your book and some of your writing, I'm going to leave alone your projection for my Tigers this year. I won't go into that too tough, but I do want you to know I was rooting, and I wasn't happy with your projection for my Tigers.
Wait a second. I wrote a column for people who don't know. I write for a site called Grantland.com, and the idea that I wrote about was over-unders for the baseball season. Vegas put that line and says, this team's going to win this, and this team's going to win that. My only objection was I didn't think the Tigers would win 94 games. I think they're going to probably run away with the AL Central. I'm just not sure they're a 100-win ball club, despite the fact they have a lot of power. They do have a couple holes with the defense, and Fitzer now being hurt and so forth. They're still going to win 90 games. They're still going to be a fine team. I just don't think they're going to be the most dominant team in the history of baseball.
Okay. I can give you that. Did you see the reports coming out of Detroit today that Z-Martin maybe coming back at the end of the season?
Perfect. Well, they're going to have 6 DHs in the lineup instead of 5. That's tremendous. Good news.
Yeah, I think today's DH, Andy Dierks, may have a problem with that, but I was more than ecstatic.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, and he's a likable player and a good player, so we'll see what happens. It actually does create, I mean, I'm partially joking, but I'm partially not. It creates an interesting lineup situation. Who do you put where, and what do you do? Does Zelman sit on the bench? I mean, there are all kinds of scenarios in play with all the numbers that they have. I mean, these are all good hitters, but they have to find positions for all these guys, and it's not the easiest thing to do.
Indeed, indeed. But let's jump into your book. You wrote about the Tampa Bay Rays, and they're taking an interesting approach to winning, if I can say so myself. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about the Tampa Rays and what they've done to compete in that tough AL East?
Well, I mean, it's been a lot of things. You know, they're really focusing on under-the-radar methods for winning games. So one of the things that they've been emphasizing for years now is defense. And you know, we had the Moneyball era, and the idea was get on base and hit the PED and steroids era, where the idea was hit home runs, and they had these big fat guys who couldn't really field, but they could hit 30 home runs and walk 100 times. Those are useful players, but the Rays sort of realized, hey, there's no more value in those players. We got to find something else. So they started looking for, you know, guys with diverse skills. They could run a little bit, they could catch the ball, they could play multiple positions, and that's really worked out for them. One of the, maybe the poster child for that is Ben Zobrist, who isn't a burner necessarily, but he'll give you 20 steals. He plays great defense, not just the one position, he'll play the multiple positions, second base, and in the outfield, he's played some other spots too. They got him for nothing. They basically got him from Houston in kind of a throw into a trade. He was a good bench player. They decided to stick him in the lineup, and he became Zorilla. He became this power hitting all around, steals and defense and power, and just had everything going on. He was this great player, and they just have this uncanny knack for turning up gems like that. They develop good players too. I mean, Evan Longoria and David Price and BJ Upton, these are all number one draft choices. These are guys with a strong pedigree, and they've been very good too. But the ability to sell out the rest of the roster is what really impresses me, because I think the one criticism that gets leveled against the Rays a little bit is, hey, if you suck for 10 years, you can get all these number one picks, and it's really easy. Oh, well, gee, where are the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Baltimore Orioles and the Kansas City Royals? Do they have World Series pennants and I missed it? You know, they're not doing that well, despite the fact that they've sucked for a long time. But the Rays have found a way in that, yes, they draft well, but they just do such a good job of supplementing the roster, too. And I think the other big point is that once they get these guys and they're coming up, they sign them to these contracts. I mean, I don't know, man. These players, it looks like they're getting snookered a little bit. Longoria is signed to a 9-year, $48 million contract. I mean, I would love to make $48 million, but for a baseball player of Longoria's stature, that's an unbelievable deal for the Rays. Matt Moore, granted, you know, they gave him job security and financial security 9 innings into his major league career, but they're basically paying him $14 million for 6 years with some club options. That could be another monster deal in favor of the Rays. They're willing to take a risk earlier in guys' careers, but so far all these deals have paid off. You look at Crawford, was signed to a long-term deal. That worked out before he ultimately left. Same thing with Shields. Same thing with Longoria and Zobrist and Matt Moore and all these guys. They find talent. They identify talent. They nurture talent. And then they find a way to sign them for much less than anybody else would. That basically is the extra 2%.
And, you know, thanks to you and your book, I got to say, when they're not playing the Tigers, I've got Rays fever. I was at the game today. I'm pointing out to my wife, look how they're lining up. You see that shift there? She's like, wow, I've never seen that. And it's kind of like, you know, they get underappreciated. Nobody really ever thinks they're going to win. But it's something that they're doing that just has them there every year. And
yeah,
I think
no doubt. Go ahead.
I think you brought that out really well in your book when you talked about, you know, the new front office. They got rid of the old owner, which you really did a great job of making him seem like the villain, so to speak, against Anomaly. I mean, I really detested this guy as I'm reading your book. And then I find myself cheering for the Rays to do well with this new front office of Matt Silverman, Andrew Friedman, and Stuart Sternberg.
Yeah, no question. Well, and the thing is, I mean, in my real life, I'm a nice guy. I'm Canadian. I'm a mild-mannered guy. I don't go after people. But this guy, Namoli, I mean, he was a gem, man. I think my favorite, and there are a lot of stories, but my two favorites, number one is he invited the local high school marching band to come sing the national anthem. And they get to the ballpark, and they've got all their band uniforms and everything like that. And they're told, oh, no, you can't get into the stadium unless you buy a ticket. And they were dismissed from the stadium. That was fun. I enjoyed that one. And I think the other one that really caught my eye was this elderly couple, and they came with the old folks home. They go to the ballpark, and show up at the on the front gate, and this lady's in a wheelchair. She's diabetic. She's 80 years old. She's in a wheelchair with her elderly husband. And the gate agent says, hey, what do you got on that over there in your hand? She says, oh, I got a little Ziploc bag full of cashew nuts. She's got, whatever, 10, 15 cashew nuts. It's just basically to keep her blood sugar up, she says. I'm sure that's fine. He goes, oh, no, you can't do that. No, you're not allowed to bring anything into the stadium. And she says, well, I mean, I could go with a diabetic coma. I absolutely have to have it. I need to have it close to me just in case. And, you know, it's hard to get the concessions, and just let me hang on to it. The guy says no. And basically, the husband intervenes, and a fight ensues. So there's a 20-year-old obnoxious guy who's arguing with this 80-year-old guy over whether his 80-year-old wife, who's in a wheelchair and is diabetic, can bring in a bag full of cashew nuts into the stadium. They kick them out of the stadium, make them go back and wait on the old folks bus for 3.5 hours while the whole game is going on and all their old folks' friends are in the stadium. That was Vincent Nimmoli. So, honestly, anybody would have been an upgrade from those guys. But, yes, it is the case of Stu Sternberg, the new owner, and Matt Silverman, the team president, Andrew Friedman, the general manager, do a great job on the field and off the field. They market very well. They find ways to, you know, turn over revenue sources. They don't draw all that well, which is unfortunate. But they do these little things that help here and there. And, of course, their ability to produce and retain talent is really second to none for a team with that low payroll.
Now, the new front office, Silverman, Friedman, and Sternberg, where did they come from? Where are they getting these principles from?
So they're Wall Street guys, and the subtitle of the book, The Extra 2%, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Team from Worst to First, which sounds very fancy, but it's pretty simple. The two of them, Sternberg and Silverman, came from a company called Goldman Sachs, which basically rules the world. It's a big investment bank. And they did all kinds of things, mergers and acquisitions, major deals, and they worked together, and they were making a lot of money, especially Sternberg. In fact, the company that Sternberg was with, which was bought by Goldman Sachs, he was one of the six partners. They were bought for $6 billion back in 2000. So Sternberg obviously has a knack for the deal and could do good things. And the two of them were working together, and then ultimately, we're about to leave Goldman, and we're trying to figure out what to do. And Sternberg said to Silverman, hey, would you be willing to try to help me pursue buying a baseball team? And Silverman, who was a young guy in his 20s and loved baseball, grew up a Cubs fan, said, sure, sounds great, let's do it. So they went ahead and did that. They bought the club. And Silverman was friends with Friedman. And Silverman introduces Friedman to Sternberg, and they get to talking. And it's just obvious that they're birds of a feather, and they get along very well. And Friedman was also a Wall Street guy. He worked for a private equity firm, which basically means that you're investing in kind of up-and-coming companies before they go public. You're almost like a venture capitalist, I guess, in some ways. You're trying to find hidden sources of talent, hidden sources of value. It's the same idea with baseball and with private equity. And so they felt that Friedman would be a good candidate. Also a big baseball guy, limited baseball experience. He could play at Tulane. He was a pretty good center fielder, but hadn't done anything from a managerial standpoint. So they sort of become partners. Sternberg becomes partners with Nimmoli for a little while, and they're both owning a part of the team. And Silverman and Friedman get their feet wet. And then eventually, Sternberg buys the team outright, and then the young guys take over. So Friedman took over as general manager. He was 28, and I think Silverman was also 27 or 28 when he was the president of a major league franchise. But, I mean, you can't argue with success. You know, you could say, well, I don't know if I want to entrust the franchise to these young guys. But, I mean, heck, they've made the playoffs 3 out of 4 years. They're looking very good this season. Despite the fact that they are struggling to draw, they're still profitable. They're hoping to build a new stadium. I mean, good things are happening. There was never anything good that had happened with this team once they had that initial opening day in 1998. It was pretty much downhill after that until the new regime took over, and now there are lots of good things happening.
Yeah, I love it. I love the new regime. I love what they're doing. But something caught my eye in the offseason. I saw the Houston Astros make a run at Friedman, the GM over there. Do you think he would consider leaving the Rays? And if so, what do you think it would take to get him out of there?
Well, one of the interesting things about the Rays, and I didn't make a huge deal about it, I mentioned it in the book, but I didn't go into that much depth, is the fact that Matt Silverman and Andrew Friedman do not have contracts. They have a handshake agreement with Sternberg. And Sternberg just says, okay, here's what I'm going to pay you. And they say, okay, that's cool. Just wire it to my bank account. We're all good. I mean, this is, beyond just a business relationship. They're very, very close. There's extreme trust. I mean, I don't care what kind of job you have. If you're cleaning houses or pushing papers or whatever, if you're making $30,000, you want a contract, let alone if you're making, a couple $1 million a year. But that is the case with these guys. And so I think that level of trust and intimacy and having an owner who is interested and invested in the team and communicates with those guys, but not someone who meddles, it's not a Peter Angelo situation, is just ideal. So Friedman's from Houston. That's why part of the reason the Houston job was attractive. Obviously, it would have been a chance to rebuild a franchise in a big market, actually. Houston has a lot of potential financially. And he's from there, and he could have gone back and done well in front of his family and friends. And all that's very attractive. But, if you work in an ideal working situation where your boss is supportive of you and absolute trust, and you don't have to worry about anybody looking over your shoulder, that's invaluable. Maybe you would rather live in New York, or maybe you'd rather hang out with your family and friends in Houston, or maybe you'd rather see what, Kansas City is like, whatever. But, the bottom line is, to have that kind of environment, I think we'd all kill for that, right? Wouldn't it be great to have that kind of boss and that kind of workplace, and you go into work every day and you're happy? That is what Matt Silverman and Andrew Friedman have, and that's why I think it's possible that eventually they go somewhere else. But honestly, I'm not sure that would happen until Sternberg leaves. If Sternberg sells the club, all bets are off, because I think Friedman and Silverman could go too. But as long as Sternberg owns the Rays, I have a hunch that those two other guys might hang around for a while.
I hope they do, because like I said, I'm having fun watching them. You mentioned in the Moneyball era when guys were, everybody, all the teams were looking for guys who were getting on base, and now we've got the extra 2% and it's letting all the teams know about these Wall Street principles. Have you seen any other clubs using these Wall Street principles? And if so, who's doing it well and who should probably go on to something else?
Well, this idea of Wall Street principles is pretty broad, right? I mean, we're just basically talking about uncovering value, and every team tries to do that to some extent. I will say the one front office that impresses me is the Toronto Blue Jays, and they get a lot of credit in the kind of analytical circles for what they've done, and it manifests itself in many ways. I mean, you know, obviously they're trying to draft well and develop well and sign good contracts. Jose Bautista signs a $65 million contract. I mean, Jose Bautista might be the best hitter on planet Earth. He's only making $65 million. That's pretty good. You know, Ricky Romero signed to a contract where he's probably going to be a little bit underpaid, and the Jays are benefiting from that. So they do a good job with all that stuff. But they do these little things. You talk about these extra 2% advantages. One of the things the Jays did last year, they stockpiled relief pitchers. Not studs, not guys making, you know, $15 million a year who are big-time closers, but just pretty good relief pitchers. They didn't pay them all that much money. But because of the weird free agent compensation rules in baseball, by signing all these guys to one-year contracts, you let them pitch. It pitch well. Most of these guys pitch pretty well. And then at the end of the year, you collect all these draft picks because they leave. Someone else finds them. You get compensation. So as a result, the Jays ended up with a whole bunch of picks in this last draft. In fact, the two teams that had the most picks by far were the Rays and the Jays. I think the Rays had 12 of the top 89 picks, I want to say. That's by far the most in the history of the draft. That's never happened before. Well, the Jays had something like 7 of the first 60, too. They had a bunch as well. So they're getting those tricks. The tricks that the Rays are doing, the Jays know what's going on, too. And I'll tell you what makes the Jays maybe scarier than the Rays in some ways. I don't know if you've ever been to Toronto. Toronto's a huge city, man. It's huge. It's probably about the fifth biggest metropolitan market in North America, maybe fifth or sixth. It's just gigantic. And so it sets up all this potential where huge city. In the past, they filled that stadium. Skydome once drew 4 million fans back in their heyday in the 90s. So that's in play, just the number of people and potential enthusiasm. And the fact that they're owned by Rogers Communications, which is like being owned by AT&T. It's a massive telecommunications conglomerate. It basically controls Canada. It's almost like a monopoly. So you've got money from the corporate side. You play in this huge city, and you're run by guys who really, really know what they're doing. I mean, it's like the Rays on steroids, basically. I would be... No, frankly, a little bit concerned if I'm a fan of the Yankees, the Red Sox, or the Rays, that the Jays are going to come up and bite me pretty soon, because it's getting there. They're not quite there. I don't know that they're going to make the playoffs yet, but I think they're on their way, and good things are going to happen in Toronto.
Yeah, you know, I've been to Toronto. I tell people it's like the New York of Canada. I mean, the city's amazing. It's beautiful. It's clean.
Yep.
And, you know, when it comes down to free agency, I don't know many players who, if you go to Toronto, I mean, you ultimately end up loving it. But
yeah.
They're telling me I got to wrap up soon, so I want to ask you a couple rapid-fire questions.
Sure.
You've talked a lot about Tampa needing a new stadium and how they're not drawing well, and, you know, they don't have a lot of money to compete, so they have to do some innovative things.
Yep.
If Tampa does get a new stadium and they start drawing and they're making money, what happens to the Rays? And I know that's a loaded question, but what happens to the Rays if they become a team that's drawing money and back in the house?
The thing is, it's a hard hypothetical to answer only because the time frame is so far off. Let's say that tomorrow they said, okay, I think we're going to build a stadium. From the time that you actually conceive the idea and the location to the time that you're literally throwing the first pitch, we're talking minimum of 5 or 6 years. And they're not at the stage where they know where it's going to be built or how it's going to be financed and all that. So to ask what the Rays are going to be doing, it's tough because realistically, we could be talking 7, 8, 9, 10 years. Stu Sternberg might have long since sold the team. Evan Longoria could be, you know, 37 years old on his last leg playing for the Pittsburgh Pirates. I mean, this could be a totally different situation by then. So I just think that makes it a little bit more challenging to try to project. Now, having said that, obviously, if you have more revenue, it lets you do more things. I think what would end up happening is a team like the Rays or any other team in that situation would maybe look to try to, you know, buy free agents on the open market. But I think the bigger thing is they wouldn't necessarily let their own guys go. So, for instance, they let Carl Crawford go, and you could argue maybe that was the right move. Doesn't look like he's doing all that well with the Red Sox. But David Price is going to come up for free agency in a couple of years. I mean, David Price is a great pitcher. He's a great guy. Everybody likes him. I mean, he's someone you'd want to keep with your franchise long term. I don't know that he's going to be a Ray in 2 years. I think that he's probably going to be gone. I think that he might even get traded before free agency because they have pitching depth, and most importantly, because they probably won't be able to afford him. That's the kind of thing that would change, where maybe you wouldn't necessarily go out and spend $240 million on Albert Pujols. But, gee, if you have a chance to re-sign David Price for $100 million for 5 or 6 years, yeah, you'd probably do that. I think it's more just retention of their own star players, because although they have pulled off these great deals early in the careers of Longoria and Moore and those guys, now, it doesn't work for everybody. Price has demurred, he hasn't signed anything. Maybe Desmond Jennings decides not to sign one of these early contracts. So that's the kind of thing you need to worry about, and when you don't have money, those are the kind of players that you might end up losing.
Yeah, but yeah, I hope they get it figured out because, like I said, man, I love watching those guys compete. I know you got to get out of here. You got a game to get back to, but if you could, real quick, tell the listeners about the new book that you're working on.
Sure.
I'm looking forward to it, and I'm going to pick it up when it comes out. But why don't you go ahead and share with the listeners about what you're working on?
Sure. Well, I was born in Montreal and raised, and went to college there, and family and friends still live there, and so I was a big Montreal Expos fan. Me and five other people, basically. And so, I don't know, maybe it'll be read by five other people, you and my dad, so that'll be good. We'll get 7 sales. That'll be nice. But anyway, I'm writing a book about the Expos, the history of the team from 1969 till 2004, which is as long as they existed. And it's a little bit of everything. It's going to talk about kind of the history of the city and how the team came into existence and how all that happened, down to the players. You know, I've already interviewed guys like Kim Raines and Tim Wallach and you know, Cliff Floyd, some really good players from their history. I've got Randy Johnson on my list, and Larry Walker, and Marquise Grissom, and Moises Alou. And I think that it's fun to just hear from ex-Major Leaguers, really good ones, about what was it like playing in that city, and tell me about your baseball experiences and all that. But it'll be more than that. You know, it'll be the story of the city, the story of the players, the story of why it didn't work in Montreal, and maybe a little bit of personal stuff, too. I don't usually write I, and I'm not a big ego guy in my writing or in my work. But my publisher, my editor, has tried to impress on me, hey, listen, you're writing about the Expos, it's a personal experience, go ahead and do that. So it'll be a little bit of everything. If you're into just a straight sports book, that'll be there. If you're into business and politics, that'll be there. And if you're into kind of a little bit of a, you know, half memoir, I guess that's probably going to be in there, too. So we feel like it'll be a cool project, and it's going to come out not for 2 years. It's still got a ways to go. It comes out in the spring of 2014.
Okay, we'll be looking forward to it. Do you see baseball returning to Montreal?
Oh, I don't think it's going to happen. I think that ship has sailed, and I've come to terms with it. It's a lovely city. I love going back, but, you know, I live here in Denver, and I'm happy to hop over to Coors Field and watch games here.
All right, John. Well, hey, we appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule. You stepped away from that what looks to be a blowout to talk to us. So we thank you for that. Listeners, if you want to check out Jonah's work, you can find him at www.jonahcarey.com, and that's spelled JonahKerry.com. And he also writes great baseball pieces over at Grantland.com. So do check him out. Jonah, we thank you from the bottom of our heart. We really appreciate you coming on, and we'll be looking forward to that new book.
Thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
All right. That was Jonah Carey. Mike, Hank, what'd you guys think?
That was an incredible interview. You know, I it was just fun to listen to that and just basically how the Rays have built themselves up. You know, it was funny. Someone was in a time capsule, and they was gone from 2007, and they come back now, and they would say, you know what, the Rays are trying to stay good. They say, what do you mean they're trying to stay good? They suck. You know, so just the fact that they have just been good for so long now, that this is an incredible, strategy that you're working. And it was fun to hear Jonah really talk about that.
Oh, yeah, I tell you, man, if you haven't read that book, go check it out. I mean, the Tampa Rays are doing all kinds of crazy things. I mean, they're having a tough time getting people to the game, so they hold concerts after the game kind of to bring people in. They're maximizing their assets as only some Wall Street guys can, and it's a fabulous read. If you can check it out, please do. Mike, you got any thoughts on the Rays? You want to change up your perspective on the Rays? What are you thinking?
So I liked the interview. I liked what he had to say, and to me, it just highlights the importance of scouting and player development in a baseball team. And you know, the teams that do that well, and Jonah brought that point up, that first round draft picks don't equal talent at the major league level. Even keeping talent at the major league level You know, Pittsburgh and Baltimore being great examples of guys that have just not been able to cultivate their own players. So Tampa Bay has done a great job of drafting, accruing the draft picks, but not only that, but developing those players and getting them to the major league. And that gives teams with not a lot of payroll flexibility the ability to make a choice. And one is to make investment in those players early on, which, you know, Tampa Bay has obviously done. And we've seen that before. That was John Hart's strategy in Cleveland in the 90s with, you know, Albert Bell, Manny Ramirez, and Kenny Lofton and those guys coming through. But then you also have the ability to turn those into trade chips, right? And so they're changing or trading arbitration-eligible and free agency-eligible players for young guys and prospects in other teams. So it all starts with player development. Tampa Bay has done a fantastic job with that. And I think that, more than anything else, has led to their success.